Between the Rows is brought to you by Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST. Experience the latest, most efficient fertilizer system for delivering sulfur and phosphate to your crops when they need it. Learn how to boost your soil's performance and maximize ROI with Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST at smartnutritionmst.com.
Hi, and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Laura Rantz. As we record this week's episode, we're experiencing what could be the warmest weather we're going to see here on the prairies for a while. A little later, I'll be talking to Bruce Burnett, Director of Weather and Markets Information for Markets Farm, about what's in store for us next. We'll also be talking about some upcoming online events that might help you fill those stormy days ahead. But first up, I have a conversation with some very special guests, talking about an organization that has a special place in the hearts of Canadian farmers. When I was growing up on a farm in southern Manitoba, this was the time of year when my father loaded up a truckload of grain and hauled it to the elevator as a donation to a fledgling organization called the Canadian Food Grains Bank. At the time, that donation of grain was physically shepherded through the grain handling system, loaded on ships, and carried to far-off places in the world to feed hungry people. At the risk of dating myself, that was 50 years ago. The Canadian Food Grains Bank of today is a much more sophisticated hunger relief and human development organization. This partnership of 15 Canadian churches and church-based agencies are working together to end global hunger. The funds they raise through donations are matched several times over by the Canadian government, which looks to agencies like these to help deliver on this country's commitment to international development. We recently learned that Jim Cornelius, the man at the helm of the Canadian Food Grains Bank for more than two decades, is stepping back to make way for a new addition to the team, Andy Harrington. I spoke to both of them about the transition and the challenges ahead.
Andy, I've crossed paths with Jim Cornelius multiple times over the past 23 years, and I guess my first question for you is, do you have your running shoes on?
I am going to have a big set of running shoes just to fill in for Jim's boots. He says he has small feet, but I think he's got the largest in the business. I've got a hard act to follow.
I guess, Sandy, I just wanted to start a little bit by getting a bit of background about your life's journey and what drew you to the Canadian Food Grains Bank to take on a role like this.
Sure. Well, my work has always been engaged around the issues of poverty and justice. So I started work back in the 80s in the UK. You can probably tell from this accent I'm not from around here. And I was working with marginalized young people in some of the rougher areas of the UK, headed up teams that would be working in some of the council estates that you might see on the TV there. From there, I got more involved in relief and development work. I ended up working in Bosnia and Croatia during the war there. I did a lot of relief work into refugee camps and worked with kids that have been traumatized by the war. Moved to Canada in 99, so I'm actually a Canadian citizen, and was working for an organization called Youth Unlimited, Youth for Christ, and a lot of our work was international in its context. So we had programs in over 17 countries around the world, and I got very engaged in particular in work in East Africa, and that led me to actually taking on a full-time position, heading up an institution that worked in quality education called the Wellspring Foundation for Education. I spent the last 8 years of my life as the CEO there. And although we worked in education, a lot of our work actually came to do with food security. So we were working with over 200,000 children, but most of those children came from families of great poverty. So we were dealing with food programs and feeding programs in schools and in communities. And through that, I became aware of the Food Grains Bank. And that's a long story of how I actually got to be here, but it very much aligns with my beliefs, my understanding of what our work should be in the world, and also of what I think is very important. My values and Food Grains Bank are very closely aligned.
So, Jim, you know, as I look back over the past two decades and you came to the Canadian Food Grains Bank at a fairly pivotal time in its development and its evolution into the organization it was today. I mean, back in its early origins, it was really about connecting farmers who were donating bags of grain every year and sending them off to hungry people in other parts of the world. What were some of the highlights, I think, of that transition as as you've been part of it over the past two decades?
Well, as when I took on the job, I had some friends who questioned my wisdom. They said, you know, isn't this organization a little sort of working in a model that is yesterday's model, you know, shipping food, bagging food, and just doesn't this, you know, hasn't its best before date passed and it should be thrown out? And I disagreed with that because at the heart, I mean, the fact that people need food and they need it today, not when you can get around to getting everything sorted out. There is a need for food today. For a school child needs to eat today if he's going to learn. You can't sort of say, well, after you got an education, we'll get all this food stuff sorted out. And so I really felt that it was just at the heart of critical things. Yes, we were going to have to change the way we worked and make some changes and adjustments to that. But we didn't have to change the fundamental concept and principles of solidarity, of sharing. And so, as you know, going back then, we used to have a lot of grain drives and farmers would show up at the elevator on same day and deliver stuff. Well, that stopped working, right? That system. However, the idea of farmers still sharing didn't stop. And so began to change how we did that work. And then the idea of community growing projects emerge where farmers would get together, grow a crop. Eventually, we persuaded the government of Canada that maybe we shouldn't just be sending food from Canada, but we could use the proceeds to buy food close to the area of need. That was a 10-year effort, a policy effort to get that policy change. But you work away at these things and make the adjustments. And so that I'm feeling now, some 23 years later, that the Food Grains Bank is more relevant than ever. And we're well positioned to continue doing the work that we need to do. And we have not lost that sense of community spirit and engagement and support from the farming community, the agriculture community, so many rural families. That has not been lost in this transition.
And looking back, that shift in federal policy away from tying aid to Canadian commodities, that has to have been a real pivotal shift in how we support development in other parts of the world.
Yeah, it was a major change, and it would not have happened without the support of our farm supporters. As you well know, I mean, this is something where the international development minister would go to cabinet table and say, I want to do this. And the minister of agriculture would say, let's have a side conversation, and it would get blocked, right? Because it was seen as a bit of a support program for Canadian farmers. And so we had lots of conversations with our supporters who said, this is the right thing to do. And then they sat on the committees on the Canadian Federation of Agriculture with the Western Canadian wheat growers. And they went and lobbied their own farm groups to say, this is the right thing to do. And I remember making a presentation to the trade committee of the Canadian Farmers Federation, looking around that committee and saying, being able to count a good number of Food Grains Bank supporters are on that committee that were prepared to speak in favor of this change. And with that, it really did break break it open. And so I really give the credit to the Canadian farmers.
You know, the Food Grains Bank, and I'll draw both of you into this discussion, but Food Grains Bank has been on the forefront of disasters. You've been on the forefront of climate change. You've been on the forefront of almost everything imaginable, and now we're in the midst of a global pandemic. But how is it affecting you on the front lines in the areas of the world that you work?
The World Food Program, we're projecting that around 680 million people were going to be in acute hunger this year. We're now projecting they're now projecting between 135 to 220 million more. And that's largely as a result of COVID. And that's not because of the actual the disease itself. It's the breakdown of the supply chains that's happening. And I had personal experience of that. I was actually on the ground in Rwanda in March, Rwanda and Uganda. And I was there just as the lockdown was beginning in that country. And it was a very, very acute lockdown. And within 3 days, in the areas that we were working with in my old organization, we moved from fairly stable supply to massive food insecurity because the supply chains broke People couldn't get to market to buy. People couldn't get to market to actually sell. Transportation was nowhere. And people don't have the ability and the resilience that we have in our country. And so very, very, very quickly, the organization I was part of had to move to emergency relief. At a time when we were hoping we would start to see hunger decrease, which actually hasn't happened over the last 5 years, by the way, it has been growing. We had seen this massive bulge now in the system due to all of the complementary effects of COVID. So that has had big complications for us. And we have a number of projects that have started as a result of that and a number of others in the pipeline subject to funding we're hoping to get in the short term. So Jim, you can probably say more about that as well.
Yeah, I think when the pandemic broke out, of course, we had to think, what do we quickly do as staff, but how do we keep projects going and make sure everything goes? And so I quickly said to staff, we need to think of ourselves as an essential service in this business. This isn't the time to hunker down. But just like in Canada, I mean, farming was said, we need to keep the farming going. We need to keep our grocery stores open. We need these core functions going on. So we very quickly pivoted to how do we make sure we keep everything moving forward? And our partners on the ground were really able to do that very well. So we've really not missed a beat in terms of our core emergency work. And then what Andy was says, we've now been developing new programs and additional things to meet the new needs coming up. So I've been really, and the support we've received from the growing projects all put crops in the ground. I had sort of thought, well, this would be a good excuse to say, we're going to take a year off. And nobody took a year off. They put crops in the ground and made it happen. Our donors traditional have continued to support us, so we've been able to not have to retrench during this time when food needs are going up. We've been able to expand, which has really been wonderful.
When you look at how, again, this is an eventuality. It's a natural force that seems to slice through all of the ideology. It slices through all of our assumptions about how we should do things. How does it affect your strategy going forward?
Well, Andy, I'm handing this over to you.
No, it's a great conversation. So one thing I would say, even as I introduce that, or you introduce that subject, is I have the great privilege that Jim has agreed to stay on as a special advisor to the executive director. So not only is Jim becoming a good friend, he is a source of wisdom. So I can say some things about that, but it is I'm building on the shoulders of giants. So as we go forward into this, we have already, as I say, adopted some emergency measures, and as Jim's brought out, those things are in place. We have put together a number of potential projects at the moment. We're in negotiation with the government of Canada and have a mechanism in place in order to really respond strategically to some of the problems that we're seeing in this crisis. And what I mean by that is not actually only meeting the immediate aims, but looking at longer term stability. So we put a whole plan in place that we're hoping to be able to activate very quickly that really does that, that moves us into what we call, it's kind of what the technical term is, nexus funding. So it would move us from immediate crisis response into make longer term agriculture and livelihood sustainability so that we can see people become much more sustainable in the context of the current crisis. And I think that's a really important, and as you talk about strategy, Laura, I think that's a really important thing for us to be looking at as we go forward. The efforts of a lot of Canadian humanitarian work has really focused on initial short-term crisis and response, and that has been wonderful and absolutely necessary. And we can't lose sight of that as we go forward. But one of the things that Food Grains Bank has also been able to do is to look at longer-term programming that has allowed people to think through how can we lift people out of hunger on a more permanent basis. And as I think we go forward strategically, those are the sort of areas we want to look in more depth at. And that's actually a very complex thing as you see the trajectory of moving from sudden onset crisis to longer-term sustainability. But I think our mission to end global hunger requires that we start to think strategically along those lines.
What do you do to keep that on the radar of people living in societies who are just saying, well, we're just going to hunker down and ride this through and look after our own needs right now.
I think that's what I feared would happen when the pandemic hit. But in fact, that's not how our supporters responded. They, in fact, did say, yeah, we've got issues at home. We need to deal with them. But it's not an either or choice. We can do both. And we also need, we also understand this is really impacting others and we can be there for them. And, you know, out talking, you know, haven't had as much personal contact, but I've had lots of conversation with farmers in the last little bit. And they're very conscious that, yeah, they understand sort of the impact on them. They can well imagine how this would impact others and that there is this sense of solidarity with others in the same situation that they're experiencing. And so, and that's the message we've been conveying to our political leaders as well, saying that Canada, yes, we need to be, you know, taking care of what we need to do here at home. But that doesn't need to be at the expense of also reaching out to places around the world. And so those are conversations we've been having with members of parliament, with the minister, with senior government officials, and I think getting a receptive ear to those conversations.
And I think something I'd like to add to that, just from, you know, the wider perspective of how Canadian development and how Canadian charities work, Canadians are generous people. They have an understanding of what global citizenship is about. And so whilst we can look around the world and see walls being built and the rise of nationalism and all that happens with that, Canadians really are a little different. And that's been the experience that I think has come to the fore in the midst of this crisis. So whereas other countries perhaps have turned more inwards, Canadians have turned more outwards. Charitable giving has not been affected to the level, anywhere near the level we thought it would be when we made some projections back in March. The Canadian government has recognized that there is a place for Canadians to play on the international scene in terms of funding food security, in particular, around the world. Rural Canadians, farmers, the growing projects that we have at the moment are having some of the bumper years that we've seen for a while. So we haven't seen people turn inwards. And maybe that's different around the world, but it certainly hasn't been the Canadian way. And I think that will pay great dividend for Canadian global leadership in the future. People will remember how we've responded. And I think that Canadians can be very proud of themselves at the moment.
Well, thank you to both of you, and congratulations to both of you as you transition into new roles.
Thank you so much, Laura. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you, Laura.
That was Jim Cornelius and Andy Harrington, the past and present executive directors of the Canadian Food Grains Bank. This is Between the Rows. I'm Laura Rance. For our next item, we take a closer look at fall fertilizer management in a special feature sponsored by Nutrien. Here is Grain News editor Carrie Belanger and Nutrien's senior agronomist Christy Preston.
Hello everyone, I'm Carrie Belanger, editor of Grain News, and I'm here with Christy Preston, who has a PhD in soil fertility and is a senior agronomist with Nutrien. Today, we're taking a closer look at how humidity and the effects that humidity has on fertilizers. Welcome, Christy. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me, Carrie.
Now, Christy, would you explain the relationship between fertilizers and critical relative humidity?
So to start with, Carrie, it's important that we know that fertilizers, the majority of fertilizers are salts. And since they are salts, that means they will absorb moisture. Critical relative humidity is just a value that fertilizers are given to kind of say where, at what humidity they're going to start absorbing moisture. So having a high critical relative humidity is better, which means there could be more moisture in the air with less accumulation. So a low critical relative humidity would mean that if there's not a lot of moisture in the air, those fertilizers are still going to be absorbing moisture.
Right, thank you. And what are the potential issues with respect to fertilizers with low critical relative humidities that farmers should be aware of?
So a lot of times, low critical relative humidity means not a lot of moisture in the air, and the fertilizers are going to take in more moisture. This leads to fertilizer caking, pile sets, and that is potentially dangerous whenever we talk about storage and being able to move fertilizers. But at the same time, it's also, it could be detrimental to a farmer, because if a fertilizer has caked and those granulars are stuck together, then it's not going to spread evenly in the field. You're going to see areas of striping where, you know, you potentially have nutrient deficiencies.
What are some of the critical relative humidities of some common fertilizers?
So when we talk about fertilizers that have low critical relative humidities, we're talking about urea and ammonium sulfate. They're both around that high 70, low 80 range. MAP and potash and some other specialty products that are on the market have higher relative humidities. What that means is fertilizers like urea and ammonium sulfate, they don't do good in high humid areas.
Now, why is all of this important for farmers to know?
It's most important because if a farmer is trying to use, say, a low critical relative humidity fertilizer like urea, he needs to know that he's not going to be able to blend it with a lot of other fertilizer sources in humid environments, or whenever it comes to storing it, either at the retail locations or on farm. They need to make sure that they're keeping moisture out of the air, because that fertilizer is just going to suck it up.
What happens though when you blend fertilizer products? What happens to that critical relative humidity?
Typically, whenever you blend fertilizers together, that further lowers the critical relative humidity. So you don't really want to, say, blend urea and ammonium sulfate if you're working in high humid environments. And that's also important to a farmer, because once you blend a product, typically farmers will go ahead and apply it within a certain amount of time. They're not going to leave it sitting on the farm. And that's because the critical relative humidity is lower, there's higher potential for it to absorb moisture. So say if we blend urea and ammonium sulfate, that decreases the critical relative humidity down into the 50s. And it doesn't take a lot of moisture in the air before that blend is going to start caking and be hard to handle.
Now, are there fertilizer exceptions to this moisture absorption?
Yes, the biggest exception is elemental sulfur. And that's because elemental sulfur is not in the salt form, so it's not going to absorb moisture. Nutrien has a new product called Smart Nutrition MAP Plus MST that has sulfur present as the elemental form and has been found to not absorb as much moisture as, say, some of the other sulfur products on the market. So the critical relative humidity of Smart Nutrition MAP Plus MST has been found to be similar to MAP, so maybe around that 80 range. So it can be handled in high humid environments and can also be blended with other products without decreasing the critical relative humidity too much.
Thanks, Christy. That's some exciting news. Now, if farmers or agronomists want more information, where can they find that?
Farmers and agronomists can find more information at smartnutritionmst.com.
Well, thanks for listening, everyone, to this special feature sponsored by Smart Nutrition MAP Plus MST from Nutrien. Join us again next time for a discussion on the relationship between organic matter, soil types, the availability of sulfur to your crops, and how much sulfur you need to apply and when. Thanks so much, Christy.
Thank you, Carrie.
This is Between the Rows. I'm your host, Laura Rance. Most farm families while away at least some of their winters by attending meetings, conferences, and trade shows. Many of those events are still happening this year, just not in person. For our next item, I spoke to Iris Meck, the Director of Conferences for Glacier Farm Media, to talk about two upcoming events you might want to mark on your calendar.
Hi, Iris, and welcome to Between the Rows.
Thanks very much, Laura. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you came on as Director of Conferences for Glacier Farm Media after developing the Advancing Women conferences and running those successfully for many years. And you came in just a few months before the whole world locked down due to COVID. So what has it been like trying to get conferences organized in an environment that's been forced into a virtual platform?
Laura, I've been running conferences for the last 22 years, and I have never gone through anything like this before. I would rather do 5 in-person conferences at once than to do one virtual. It's really difficult. You want to make sure that you have all the pieces of a live in-person conference and try to make them into a virtual. And some of those things work and other things don't work. So I just hope everyone appreciates that we're here to give them information and they come and join us.
You know, I think too with these events, and we're talking about Farm Forum event, which is coming up very shortly, and the Advancing Women in Agriculture Conference, like our other events this year, are on a different platform entirely. But, you know, I think what brings people out to some of these events is the socialization or the ability to connect with people. And what do you say to people who just say it's not going to be the same?
It's not going to be the same. I'll be the first to admit that. It's not going to be the same at all, because after doing conferences for 22 years, you realize that most of the information that's exchanged is exchanged during the coffee break, during the lunches, during the banquet, out in the hallway. And that's where people really make the connection, ask the pertinent questions, get some really good ideas from people who are just like them in the same situation. And that's where they get their key information as to what they're doing today. But for now, while we are virtual, and that's not totally possible, but it still is possible because people can connect on the platforms for both Farm Forum and Advancing Women. And once you connect with someone and start and engage a conversation, you have now started to build your own personal database. So at the end of the day, at the end of the conference, print it out and you've got your own database that you can work with and refer to anytime. This is your time to connect with speakers. While their presentations are going on, people can ask questions of the speakers and get all those questions answered. Is it belly to belly? No, but we're trying to make it as network conducive as possible. And we've got a new application on our platform that allows you to sit at a table and have a discussion with a few people at a time. And I think that's going to be really interesting. So it's not the same, believe me, it's not what I would have wanted, but let's all make the best of it and get the information out there.
So as people think about what they want to do, I mean, you know, just refresh us on the dates of these events for starters. Mm-hmm.
Farm Forum is held on November the 9th and 10th, which is just coming up. And Advancing Women Virtual 2020 is going to be held on November 24 and 25. And they are 2-day conferences loaded with great speakers, loaded with super lineup of speakers and presenters. And don't turn away from it, because once you are registered as a delegate, you have the opportunity to not only participate during those 2 days, but come back up until December 31st, 2020 for both of those conferences, review any speaker that you might have missed or that you want to watch again, or if you missed a half a day and weren't able to come to it, join us up until December 31st.
So give me a quick rundown of some of the speakers that you have on the lineup.
Well, for Farm Forum, we've got a great lineup that's covering everything from crop and nutrition, soil and water management, politics, trade, the economy, and all the way through to new innovations. So we've got Andrew Coyne, who's going to have a great discussion about what's happened with the American politics and how that affects agriculture, to Sylvain Charlebois, to Kevin Hirsch, who's our MC, and a great number of great leaders in the industry, both farmers, entrepreneurs, and business leaders. For Advancing Women, we're on for those 2 days with some great motivational and inspirational speakers. We're talking about mental health and self-care. We're talking about being motivated and energized. And I think that's the big part. When you see all these great leaders on the program, they're such great role models. You know, they're telling their story about their point of view from where they came from. And so many women in the audiences that I've been to say, man, she's just like me. You know, that she was talking right to me. And so we hope that we've hit the nail on the head with all of our speakers. And I know we have. And women that attend are just going to have a really great 2-day session.
Iris, if people want to get involved with these conferences, where do they go to get more information?
Good question, Laura. They can go for Farm Forum. You go to farmforumevent.com. And for Advancing Women, go to advancingwomenconference.ca.
Thanks very much for joining us on Between the Rows, and good luck with the conferences.
Thanks so much, Laura. Hope to see you there.
That was Iris Meck, Director of Conferences for Glacier Farm Media. Now, according to our next guest, the next couple of weeks might be a good time to hunker down in a comfy chair and take in some of those online events. Here's Bruce Burnett, Director of Weather and Markets Information for Markets Farm, to talk about an incoming storm system and how the markets are reacting to ongoing world affairs.
Hi, Bruce, and welcome to the show.
Hi.
Let's start with the weather. I mean, as we're recording this today, which is November 3rd, we've got beautiful weather outside. We've had kind of an unusually cold October, but what's in store going forward here?
Well, unfortunately, and again, living on the prairies, you understand this. Eventually, good weather in November gives way to more winter-like weather. So we're going to see that for the first week in November. We're going to have above normal temperatures, highs across the southern and central prairies, you know, getting into the 20s even, certainly in the mid to upper teens for most areas of the prairies for a number of days this week. And then we're going to see a dramatic change in the weather, unfortunately. And that's going to be the result of a Colorado low that's going to turn into one of these weather bombs. And again, a weather bomb is just simply a very low pressure, a system that has an extremely low pressure. So currently the models forecast that system is going to track essentially from the U.S. into Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and then end up near Hudson Bay here by the end of the weekend into early next week. And so we're going to see a dramatic drop off in temperatures, back to below normal temperatures, not getting above the freezing mark during the day. And there's a good chance of rainfall / snowfall as the system goes across from southern Alberta all the way up into west central Manitoba. So this could be significant because that's going to hit a lot of the driest areas that we have on the prairies. And it would be really nice to see some moisture there. Unfortunately, with the winds you would expect from this, the snow, if it falls mostly as snow, it's going to blow around a lot and not be as much use. But hopefully we get some rain in advance of this system moving through that gives us some decent amounts of soil moisture to start off for next year. Again, we're not going to make up for the deficits, but that's certainly going to be a good start, or a lot better off than we currently are.
I guess the other, aside from getting some badly needed moisture, which we've talked about before, but the other bright side to this is that it's happening in November instead of mid-October, like we saw last year. And most of the crop, I mean, I think everybody's pretty much caught up with their field work, and we've had a pretty nice ride through harvest this year, haven't we?
Yes, that's right. This harvest's been a very good harvest, more or less on normal in terms of how long it's taken the farmers in Western Canada get their crops in. Some areas a little bit ahead of normal, but most of it's normal. The exceptional part of the crop this year has been the quality. Virtually all the crops that we grow are a very high quality this year, which is almost exactly the opposite to what we had last year at this time.
So, you know, another important element of this week's discussion is the U.S. election, which is taking place as we speak. How big of impact do you think it's going to have? I mean, the general markets have been very volatile leading up to this. What has it meant for ag, and what do you see happening in the near future as far as the ag markets?
Well, the agriculture markets right now are more focused on the supply and demand situation, particularly in terms of oilseed demand from China. And I think that's generally speaking a protein demand from China. They're increasing their hog herd, so they need soybean meal. So they're buying soybeans, they're buying meal products and substitutes like peas. So Canada's selling an awful lot of peas to China. So that's what the market is focused on right now. In terms of the election, I don't think there's anything right now that the market's pricing in terms of who wins the election, because I think the market's pretty neutral on who gets in as far as the agricultural space is concerned. We'll have to see, though, as we go through the election, find out who's won and what kind of policies we're going to have, I think particularly with trade with China. From the U.S. perspective.
But is demand fairly strong then? I mean, you mentioned that in our earlier conversation that the export pace has been really strong this year for some of our commodities.
Yes. And again, part of this is due to the fact that we're getting lots of railway capacity to haul our grains to ports to export. But there's also very strong offshore demand for all of our commodities. So not only wheat and canola, which garner most of the attention when it comes to crop movement, but crops like barley, which are on a record pace right now in terms of exports, essentially 3 months into the crop year. Peas, especially shipments to China, are extremely high this year as well. Even some of the more minor crops, lentils, flax, those types of crops that don't see as much bulk movement, at least anyway, are seeing some pretty strong demand from offshore.
And domestic demand, is it holding up as well?
Well, certainly domestic demand is holding up. It depends on the commodity, of course, as to how much domestic demand Canada has. But certainly, despite the fact that we're seeing increased COVID cases, seems to be a very strong demand for things like flour, oil, vegetable oil, those types of things. And I think that's also translating into the international market. There were some concerns that we were going to be stockpiling a lot of these commodities, but right now it doesn't appear as if it's stockpiling. It's just pure demand from the markets, both in domestically here in North America as well as offshore.
So pretty upbeat news, except for the fact that winter is actually going to come.
Yes, that's right. Maybe the cooler temperatures will take a little bit off of the fact that you're going to have to be loading grain trucks when it's minus 10, minus 15 degrees out. But other than that, prices, are a lot higher than they were last year and appear to be keeping that strong trend.
Well, thanks very much for joining me today, Bruce.
Thanks.
That's all we have for you on this week's Between the Rows, but we'll be back again next week. I hope you'll join us. I'm Laura Ratz.
Between the Rows is brought to you by Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST. Experience the latest, most efficient fertilizer system for delivering sulfur and phosphate to your crops when they need it. Learn how to boost your soil's performance and maximize ROI with Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST at smartnutritionmst.com.